You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last night, in a display of party unity, the Democrats voted to nominate Barack Obama by acclamation. But where are the Democrats as a party heading in a year of political change? Joining me now to discuss some of the internal dynamics is David Sirota, a nationally syndicated columnist and bestselling author of The Uprising. I'm pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm okay. Barack Obama appeared via satellite on Monday, and then on Tuesday of the he appeared in person after Joe Biden's speech last night. Has he really put a stamp on this convention?
I don't think so. Not yet. Although the convention still has one more day to go, I think that that the Democratic Party has broadcast what it's about and the fact that it feels, I think, confident moving into this election. But I don't think there has been that much of an Obama flavor as of yet. And I actually don't even think there's been that much of an anti-McCain flavor either. It's been a sort of weird in that there hasn't been one overarching message other than sort of this idea that the Democratic Party is ready to move the country past the Bush era.
But it is interesting that we've known that Obama is going to be the candidate for a while. In the past, there before this current primary system, the conventions were about something quite different. So this convention should have been all about Barack Obama.
Well, you can definitely make an argument for that, and I would make that argument. I think that's been the one thing that has left I think the media and the folks analyzing this a little bit puzzled, wondering what is the overarching theme of this convention, because the conventions, you're right, have turned into basically television shows, and it's not really clear what the overarching theme has been. The question, I think, moving into tonight's speech, Obama's speech, is what theme is he going to stress most? Is he going to stress the economy most? Is he going to stress foreign policy the most? I'm hoping to hear a lot more about the economy than we've heard, I think, thematically from the campaign and from this convention.
Now, why do you think it has been so diffuse? Is this a reflection of Obama's approach, or is this something that just grew out of all the complicated strands that had to be dealt with, like Hillary Clinton, for example?
I think there's two reasons. I think that Obama's approach is to try to essentially be in some ways a blank screen by which the entire Democratic coalition can project its hopes and aspirations onto. I think the second reason is because the Democratic Party is, I think, hoping that the antithesis to Bush in the public is enough to carry it forward. That's why I think you haven't seen intense branding and more specific branding on the issues as of yet.
In our year-long series called States of the Union, we've talked about the politics in 40 states so far, and we've heard that the Obama campaign is opening campaign offices in places that are Republican strongholds, like Alaska. Will opening campaign offices make Obama competitive in those states?
I don't think only opening campaign offices will do that. I do think that it suggests that the Obama campaign is serious about a 50-state or 40-state strategy, and that I think that that would put McCain on the defensive if the Obama campaign is able to execute. And by that I mean McCain will have to spend money and resources and time in places that Republicans haven't really had to pay that much attention to in the past. And I think that that's – so I think that what Obama is banking on is not just necessarily winning some of those typically red states, but at least making McCain have to work for them.
Well, in the past they've just ignored them or considered them unwinnable and saved their money. In this case, the Democrats have more money, so they can force the Republicans to spend their money?
That's exactly right. I mean, there's only so many television ads you can put on the air without getting a diminishing return from it. So as an investment strategy, if you are flush with cash and you have bought enough television ads to saturate, then the extra money is I think, well spent in trying to compete in places like Montana, Nevada. They're close in the polls, and certainly Obama may be able to pick up those states. But I also think that the added value is making McCain have to spend their more limited resources in those places.
Although those states, the Western states, have few electoral votes.
Not necessarily
compared to some of the largest states on the national level.
Well, that's true individually, but consider this: between Colorado, Montana, Nevada, and New Mexico, there are more electoral votes there than there are in Ohio. And all of those states could quite possibly go to Barack Obama if you look at the polls. So I think that the investment is a good one. I think that the decision to hold the convention in Denver was probably a very, very smart one with that geography in mind.
Well, except for Nevada, the states you mentioned all now have Democratic governors, whereas for many years they were considered strongly Republican. So is something happening in the West? Is it because of demographic changes, for example? The influx of Hispanic immigrants sure has changed the political landscape of Nevada.
Right. I think it's a mix of a lot of things. Demographics are a huge part of it. I think that you have a new brand of Democrat running for office at all levels out here, more of a populist Democrat, a more of a pragmatic Democrat, one that is branded differently than the National Democratic Party. I also think that you have a region whose politics have shifted on key issues like the environment and energy. There has been a reworking of the coalitions out in places like this, whereas before, and I wrote about this in my book, the Republicans were able to use the spotted owl kind of situation to pit the environment against extractive industry jobs. Today you have a much larger segment of the economy in places like the West that are, if not antithetical to extractive industries, then only passively related to the professional industries. You've got large amounts of retirees, the tourism industry. These are not people or demographics that are interested in having, for instance, natural gas wells and oil rigs encroaching on their backyards and their open spaces. So that has really allowed Democrats to forge different kinds of coalitions between, for instance, hunters and gun owners and environmentalists. And that has changed the politics out here.
And what's happened to cultural conservatism, which in the 1980s played a large role in solidifying the Republican Party in the West? Colorado Springs is home to James Dobson's focus on family.
Well, cultural populism really, I think, it has been more historically powerful in the South. There is much more of a libertarian streak throughout the West. Certainly, you're right. You have pockets like Colorado Springs where focus on the family is. But this is a state and this is a region, I think, where the politics, for instance, of abortion is not a politics that's part of the lexicon, the political lexicon that moves voters out here as much as, say, for instance, taxes, the environment, jobs, and even, for instance, civil liberties. I mean, here you had we're a couple years after John Tester, the farmer from Montana, won a run for the Senate, not only saying he wanted to protect civil liberties, but actually putting campaign ads on the air, attacking the Patriot Act, saying, "I don't want to reform the Patriot Act, I want to repeal it." And he won the Senate seat in Montana. So I agree with you that cultural populism on the immigration issue, for instance, today, is certainly a powerful force. But it's much more powerful and has been much more powerful in the South than it has been in the West.
I'm talking to David Sirota, who's a nationally syndicated columnist, author of The Uprising. We're kind of taking the temperature of the Democratic Party. Didn't you work for Montana's governor, Brian Schweitzer?
I did. I worked for him for off and on from his first run in 2000 for the Senate to his 2004 run for governor, and I lived up in Montana for 3 years.
Much of his speech on Tuesday focused on energy. Is that going to be one of the central planks of his campaign?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he is running for re-election now, and I think that nationally every Democrat is talking about energy. Now, what's really interesting is in the last couple of weeks there's been this talk that Democrats are losing the energy debate because of the drilling issue. And I agree with some of it. In other words, I agree with the idea that the Democrats have not been as aggressive on the gas price crisis and in framing it as the Republicans have. What's so fascinating about that is that it goes back to a lot of Democrats' historic problem of sort of being afraid of their own shadow. When people talk about drilling as the solution to our energy problems right now, and for instance the gas price crisis, that suggests that right now the crisis has to do with a supply of petroleum and fossil fuels, which is simply not true. The Bush administration's Energy Information Agency will tell you that's not true. There's no lines at the gas station right now. Democrats have not articulated, however, that line of reasoning. They haven't said, actually, the real problem is you've got an oil industry that colludes and uses all sorts of speculation to make record profits. I mean, I'm sitting here right now in Denver in a state where the drilling battle is taking center stage in the major Senate race between Mark Udall and Bob Schaefer. Bob Schaefer is a former oil executive, and it's become conventional wisdom, not that being a former oil executive is a bad thing for a political candidate during a gas price crisis, but in fact that Bob Schaefer's oil executive experience makes him more qualified to deal with the energy crisis. The fact that Democrats have allowed that debate to get to that point, I think, suggests still that trepidation among Democrats that they've been attacked for and criticized for, and that has helped them lose elections in the past.
Well, there seems to be a real split in the party. We have people like Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who votes with the Republicans quite a bit. Congresswoman Nancy Boida in Kansas's 2nd congressional district has refused the help of the Democratic Campaign Committee, even though her seat is very vulnerable because she needs to show her independence from the party. So are we talking about different kinds of Democrats in the West and then the kind we recognize from the eastern states and from California and Oregon?
Well, I think there's a way to unify them. I mean, I really do. I think that the way to unify Democrats across regions is for Democrats to find the courage, I think, as a national party, to stand up on some of the issues that deal with big money interests. Right now, the Democratic orthodoxies of the party tend to be orthodoxies on social issues, abortion, gun control, these kinds of things. There hasn't been an orthodoxy on, for instance, the issue of free or fair trade. There hasn't been an orthodoxy on the issues of taking on corporate power and re-regulating Wall Street. Those orthodoxies, if they were to exist and if they were to grow, I think unify people across regions. They don't culturally divide the country. And I think that the good news is I think that the Democratic Party is moving towards some of those orthodoxies on economic issues. You mentioned Nancy Boida. Nancy Boida is just as opposed to expanding NAFTA-style trade deals as a lot of Northeastern liberals up in New England whose economies, industrial economies, have been wiped out as well. That is an example of where that economic populism can actually unify the party. The problem, of course, is the influence of big money on both political parties. It's hard to be an economic populist if you're raising huge amounts of corporate money for conventions like the one we saw in Denver.
So you don't see the progressives and the moderates moving in opposite directions this year?
Well, I see that the progressive wing of the party is in ascendance. I think if there's in this whole debate about whether the party's unified, I think it's been focused on, you know, the Clinton people and the Obama people, when really the party's debate has been between sort of the corporate DLC forces in the Democratic Party and the progressive, or as Paul Wellstone put it, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And I think if there's one thing that comes out of this when you talk to delegates here, when you talk to party operatives, is that the era of Clintonism, of triangulating, of sort of corporate Democratic politics, that era right now is on the wane, and there really is a progressive populism that is intensifying. Now, whether it ends up completely unifying the party over this election and the course of the next few years, that's the open question.
Now, when JFK chose LBJ as his running mate, that was intended to deliver Texas to the Democrats and other parts of the South. Joe Biden is from Delaware, a very small state. What does he really give this this team?
Well, I think Obama hopes that he gives the campaign not just foreign policy experience, but the image that while the campaign represents change, that it might not represent too much change. Now, the question, and who knows how they calibrated this, is you could go too far and undermine your entire change message. I don't think Biden does that. I don't think Biden does that because he's got a solidly progressive voting record on economic issues that are vastly different from George Bush. Of course, he's got some blemishes. He voted for the bankruptcy bill, which is one of the worst pieces of economic legislation in the last generation. But generally, he's a progressive on economic issues. I think the strangest question or the strangest phenomenon of Biden is that Barack Obama spent the entire primary saying it's not about how many years you served in Washington on an issue like the war. It's not about experience. It's about judgment. And yet he put on the ticket a guy who's supposed to represent all sorts of experience, especially on foreign policy in the Iraq War, who actually voted for the Iraq War. Now, Biden has apologized for it, said he made a mistake, but it does suggest a sort of contradiction in terms.
He also will never be forgiven by some people who are strong supporters of Hillary Clinton for what happened with Anita Hill. But he supposedly is also supposed to help with Catholic voters, and that's an area where the Democrats have been particularly vulnerable in presidential elections.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And there is a case to be made that Biden, you know, he's from Scranton originally. He represents Delaware. Now, Delaware itself is sort of a corporate banana republic. It's where most corporations incorporate because the laws are so lax there. But the Delaware media market is the Philadelphia media market and the Philadelphia suburbs, which is going to be a battleground. Pennsylvania is going to be a huge battleground, I think. In fact, I actually think that Pennsylvania is the state, the blue state, that John McCain most hopes to win next to Michigan. It's got the best shot of potentially winning. And so I think that Biden helps shore that up. How much more he actually gives you in terms of in terms of working class voters, tough to say. I mean, even though he comes from that background, he's been in Washington for 36 years. So sending out a career U.S. senator as sort of your working class spokesperson, I'm not sure how much that gives you.
Earlier this month, the New York Times reported that Obama's campaign has yet to open an office in Arkansas, Bill Clinton's state. Why is he going after other red presidential states like Montana, but not Arkansas?
Hard to say. I would posit that it has something to do with what they're reading out of the primary results in that state. And I think it has to do in some ways with racial politics. And I say that because the primary results were so telling. I wrote an article for In These Times magazine about what I called the race chasm, in that Obama was winning in the primary states that had a very small percentage of its population that was African American, and states with a very large percentage of its population that was African American. And what essentially was happening was that states that had a very small segment of their population was African American, racial politics just isn't part of the political lexicon in those states. And so somebody like Barack Obama didn't walk in with an inherent disadvantage due to racism because of his race. In states with a large black population, you had a large enough black vote to offset whatever portion of the white vote might have been racially motivated. And we know from exit polls in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio, about one in five voters said race was a factor in their vote. So it's in the middle. It's in those states that are basically between 6% and 17% black, that chasm where Obama had the toughest time in the primary. And places like Arkansas fall right into that chasm. And I think that will be, once we see how this election plays out, we'll see if that race chasm expresses itself, and I sure hope it doesn't, but we'll see if it expresses itself in as pronounced a way in the general election as it did in the Democratic primary.
So that's why he's targeting states like North Carolina and Georgia, because they have higher proportions of black voters. Then he has to rely.
Exactly.
He has to rely on the black voters to come out and vote.
Exactly.
There have been record numbers of registered voters, new voters for the Democrats, but that doesn't mean that people will come out on Election Day.
That's exactly right. He is targeting places like North Carolina and Georgia, those two red states, for instance, as an example of states on that one side of the race chasm with a very large percentage of African-American voters. And then he's targeting red states like Montana and Nevada and Colorado that have not as high, a very small percentage of African-American voters on that other side of the race chasm. Where this election will really pivot, I think, is not only in those red states, but how can McCain pick off blue states that fall within that chasm, places, again, like Pennsylvania, like Michigan.
Do you see Virginia as a red state? It hasn't voted Democratic in a presidential election since LBJ won in a landslide in 1964, but it's been electing an awful lot of Democrats recently.
Virginia is actually interesting. It's right on the cusp of that race chasm. It's got a pretty significant African-American population. It certainly has been trending blue in its statewide races. I think if any red state is going to change that could decide the election in one state as opposed to picking off a couple smaller states, it will be Virginia. I think that's a much better shot for Obama to win than, say, trying to pick off a red state like Indiana. Like when Evan Bayh, the senator from Indiana, was floated as a possible VP nominee, as a guy who could pick off Indiana, you know, you look at the voting trends in Indiana, I mean, that is not a great state for Barack Obama. Virginia is much better for him.
What do you think the Internet, what kind of role do you think it'll play in all of this? Although the Republican nominee has said he really doesn't know much about computers, it seems to me that the Republicans have been using the Internet a lot more effectively than the Democrats have, at least during the convention.
Well, I think that the Republicans have used the conservatives, or whoever you want to call them, have used the Internet pretty well to spread those lies about Barack Obama's heritage and his religion. I think that the hope for Democrats and the progressives is that they learn to use the Internet as not just a fundraising tool, which they have done very well, but as an actual organizing tool. How do you meld, for instance, the social networking technologies of places like, of sites like Facebook that allow people to self-organize? How do you meld that into organizing for a campaign? Obama has been a real pioneer on that, the Obama campaign, and we're going to see in the general election whether it can actually turn an election. In 2004, it seemed for a time that it might turn the Democratic primary through Howard Dean, but that didn't happen. And I wouldn't ascribe the Internet and Internet organizing as the reason Barack Obama won the Democratic primary. But it very well could provide the difference in a very close general election.
Can the way that the Barack Obama campaign has used the Internet serve as an example for the rest of the party? Because they were quite effective during the primaries.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think you see every kind of campaign now trying to figure out ways to creatively use the Internet. And what I think they're learning is that it can't be used in a top-down way. I mean, how many emails do we all get asking us to sign on to something, asking us to contribute to something? That is not where the Internet is going to be used most effectively. Where it's going to be used most effectively is in giving people tools to self-organize and connect with each other. The brilliance of Obama's campaign, the thing that's really exciting structurally about his campaign, is that he's really, through that MyBarackObama.com, allowed people to feel ownership over pieces of the campaign. You hear stories all the time where local grassroots groups are putting together their own flyers or their own events, and a reporter will call the campaign, the central headquarters, and say, hey, do you know about this event? And they'll say, no, we don't know about that event. And it's not plausible deniability, it's that they've actually created a situation that allows the campaign people to have ownership over autonomous parts of the campaign. That's where this campaign is really, I think, mimicking a social movement.
Although, David, my sense is that Barack Obama represents for many people the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, but everything you've been saying so far suggests that if the Democrats hope to win, they have to appeal to the more moderate Independents and Democrats, the Democrats who have voted for Republicans in the past.
Well, no, I think I'm saying both things at the same time. In other words, what
you're
I'm saying is
you're speaking out of both sides of your mouth, David?
Well, no. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I actually think that the center of American public opinion has shifted greatly, that the center of American public opinion is actually a fairly progressive center. You look at polls, you see 65% of Americans want a universal government-sponsored healthcare system. You look at polls, most Americans want a reform of our trade laws. You look at polls and you see most of Americans want out of Iraq. I could go on and on and on. The point is that you can actually appeal to quote-unquote moderate and centrist voters if you're willing to speak from the progressive center on core economic and issues of war. The problem has been, I think, is that the Democratic Party has spoken to a fake center, a center that says most people want more NAFTA, a center that says most people don't want the government to really take on health care. They only want incremental steps. A fake center. You hear this all the time. Senators who want to keep the troops in Iraq are called centrists. Appealing to that center is the way for Democrats to lose among independent and truly centrist voters.
David Sirota is a nationally syndicated columnist and author of The Uprising. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.